there, Rose City. Welcome to another exciting episode of A Radio Geekly. I'm just Jess, and I'm joined in the studio by a couple of my lovely collective members. I've got Becky. I've got Rob.
Hey.
Hello. Hey. You have it all.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday.
Yay.
It's October, but it doesn't really feel like October outside. I think Portland's still in that. What kind of weather should we be?
Oh, golly.
Yeah, it's like, it starts off at night or in the early early morning as winter, and then it becomes fall, and by midday it's summer again, and then it goes back.
It's just creeping up on you in the dark, like all the, you know, the monstery monsters do.
Yeah.
So here comes the winter, monstery monster style.
Well, I am excited to get to speak with both of you today and not only talk about the weather as crazy and weird as it is
here. Unpredictable.
And often unpredictable. We're going to talk a little bit about what we like to highlight in the Rose City today, which is makers. Makers of things and stuff. So that definition is kind of crossing over a lot of different art forms, but I wanted to get insight from us in terms of what we interpret makers to be and how we kind of define the maker movement.
Because we're brimful of insights.
Yes, and information and opinion.
Let's start with Wikipedia, shall we?
Ooh.
Right? Because Wikipedia itself is a good example of maker culture.
That's right.
So Wikipedia says that maker culture is a contemporary culture or subculture representing a technology-based extension of DIY culture that intersects with hacker culture, which is less concerned with physical objects as it focuses on software, and reveals in the creation of new devices as well as tinkering with the existing ones. So, yeah, I think that that's a pretty good starting point. So maker culture, I mean, when you think of a maker, often what comes to mind for me is somebody like welding something together or like making a wooden bench or something.
Yeah, fabrication in a way.
Yeah, something that you
more
can
artisan crafts.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's a great start to this discussion, because if we are talking about sort of the umbrella of DIY culture, then that includes like various art forms and includes other crafts. And maker culture, in the way that Wikipedia has stated it, is focused really specifically on technological pieces. And I've seen maker spaces kind of not only have that generative aspect where, like Hadron Makerspace, they have, you know, the 3D printers and things like that. And so they're really focused on creating new things. Other spaces also work in the deconstruction of things. And so a local hackerspace that just opened called Pascal and Inner Industrial Northeast, they break apart stuff. They're constantly deconstructing pieces of equipment, of software, anything in order to not only understand it, and that being a learning opportunity, but then rebuilding it in like a new unified way.
Wow. So kind of like a reusing of something that's already existing.
Yeah. And maker spaces, I feel like historically in Portland, have kind of ranged the gamut. So you have your Grange style, this is a guild of lots of other stuff, kind of community supported everything places. And then you have, you know, places that are really focused on the sharing of art and like this industrial space, like, you know, manifestation even. So there are a lot of different ranges of places, and they all focus in some way on technology, which is exciting.
Yeah. I now, when you describe it like that, that makes me sort of revisit my industrial design education.
Oh, yes.
Where I'm like, wait, is the maker culture just a reflex action that's post-dating the Industrial Revolution? Because the Industrial Revolution basically canceled the arts and crafts movement.
Oh, yeah, totally. Like, cottage crafts, all that.
Yeah. You can make one artisanal bench per hour. I can make 50 with my machines. And I think what happened there, like what, well, it was awesome because that enabled the general quality of life, well, at least based on ownership of objects, to come up. But it sacrificed in doing so the ability to have ownership of those objects. And I think that's what we're taking back with the maker movement.
Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know, when you make something, you really own it. Like,
yeah.
You know, every screw, every nail, every, you know, line of code, if you write code.
Right.
And it's interesting to think about how, I mean, we see, you know, certain software companies like making piece of their code totally inaccessible. And granted, that's to protect their proprietary, goods, mm-hmm. Their IP. But at the same time, it starts to make software more of a mystery in how it functions.
Mm-hmm.
But the reflex to that is these open source communities,
right,
where the belief is we can build something better as a group rather than somebody builds something and continues to build something within their niche.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think that description of the Industrial Revolution and sort of the taking away of like individual agency and creativity, and then the idea of this alienation, like you are technically still making something if it's on a, like, you know, an assembly line, but you're not really, like, that it's part of this like orchestrated thing that you were simply assisting. And so, like, it all kind of boils down to an interesting like philosophical and political thought system that kind of came from that, where like we are talking about that alienation and people having had the experience not even a generation before of being able to build something and like having that as a piece of ownership. Like I can transfer my like being and my understanding of that to an object that I myself have created.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really cool that you can bring it back and say like, okay, we're reclaiming that.
Yeah, and it's interesting when you phrase it as a generation before, because I'm thinking about the trajectory of computer assembly.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Where a generation before, it was literally like folks soldering together computers.
Right.
Granted, you could buy an insanely expensive computer, you know, from a magazine.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah.
You send away your check.
Right, you get yourself a room of computer.
Yeah, because there are rooms full, ladies and gentlemen. There weren't any handheld computers quite yet.
There were binders full of computers.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because out of that sort of weird purchase mechanism before the internet was a thing, we got the two giants of industry. Literally, Microsoft and Apple came out of a garage.
Yes.
And I think that's an amazing testament. And you could see how those two have swung. Well, Apple swung way in the direction of don't open it. If you open it,
you avoid everything.
We have taken every part that you could open and taken it away from you.
So it's interesting that we're swinging back now. And I believe we have a caller on the line that can tell us more about building your own computer these
days. Yeah, I think we might get to connect with him just a second. But I wanted to chime in for myself. I kind of like the maker movement in terms of how it builds community together. I like the aspect of everybody joining in to create something, not only individually, but can actually utilize their brain power to contribute to a group.
Oh, yeah.
And so I think that's really great because there's, you know, there's power in community. And so being able to utilize your skills, but also being able to translate that with other folks.
Yeah, and using that as a means to test the like this whole collectivism, like how not simply in pursuit of one particular goal, but like how do we then transfer that particular type of way of working to all aspects of our life, which is cool.
Yeah,
this is
awesome. So, and to not keep our phone caller waiting, we've got Dan Bartholomew on the line.
Hello.
Good morning, Dan. How's it going today?
Good morning. It's a great morning. It's a great Free Geek morning.
Yay!
Mentioning Free Geek, you are actually the CEO of Free Geek. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Awesome. Well, thanks for taking a moment of your morning to chat with us about the maker movement.
So, Dan, can for anyone on the line and listening who doesn't know what Free Geek is, can you give us a rundown of, you know, what it is, maybe a mission statement and And any other viable details you might want to include?
Sure, absolutely. Well, I'll start with the mission because that's what it's all about. We sustainably reuse technology, enable digital access, and provide education to create a community that empowers people to realize their potential. So I love the conversation that I came in on talking about how the makerspace creates community, because that's a lot of what Free Geek's about. We were started in 2000 by Oso Martin, who had the vision that we were going through technology changeover so quickly that they were filling up landfills. And yet there were so many people that were not able to get that technology because they simply couldn't afford it and didn't have the access. So pointing those two problems at each other is really where Free Geek was born. We were in the Oregonian the day that we started on Earth Day 2000. And the Oregonian's headline was, "Get a free computer from Free Geek." And we had people out the door, around the block, waiting to get a free computer.
Holy cats.
That is something you would wait in line for.
Yeah, then you had to explain to them then that they had to give community service in order to do it. So what we've been doing for the last 17 years is really providing a space for the community to get together and learn about computers while reusing computers. So we have labs set up where volunteers come in, volunteer their time, and help us to rebuild the computers that we have been granted by individuals in the community or corporations, City of Portland, Multnomah County. They donate all their technology to us. We then go through it and we reuse it by rebuilding it through our volunteer program, or we recycle it sustainably. So since our inception, we've processed about 1.3 million items.
Whoa.
Just last year, we did about a million. We diverted about a million tons of e-waste from going to landfills.
I think that's a round of applause.
Yes, yay! Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, we actually turned around last year. We turned around 42,000 items back into the community.
Wow.
Yeah.
Incredible.
So we've got some great programs. We've got a program that's called Plug Into Portland, where any child, K through 12, that volunteers anywhere in Portland, gets a free computer from Free Geek after 24 hours of service.
That's awesome. And I know Kibu has donated a few technological items to you guys. So
and have also been granted items as well, which is incredible service that you provide to nonprofits.
Yeah.
Thank you for bringing that up. Yeah, we do. We grant, on average, between 6 and 8 organizations a week with all of the equipment that they need to get started or to go to the next level with their computing equipment. And a lot of times that starts with somebody who, you know, loves dogs, and they have this great dog nonprofit, doesn't know anything about computers, right? So they call in, they fill out the grant form, then they call into our people, and our people help advise them and figure out what it is that they actually need. Mm-hmm. And then we have that stuff that we refurbish and we give back to them. They come in and pick it up. And that's anybody from Habitat for Humanity all the way to, you know, mother and child. So that's a wonderful thing that we like to do.
That's very cool.
Wow.
You go first.
I was going to ask, so for those folks who are listening who may want to get involved, what would be the best route to discover your opportunities to, say, volunteer at Free Geek, if there's workshops available or stuff like that? Where would we go to find this?
Well, you know, this is really timely because we're launching a brand new website in the next 2 weeks.
Congratulations.
Yay.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Yeah, that was a summer effort. Believe me, that was a summer effort. Mm-hmm. And that was the whole team here. We have 40 staff, and so everyone contributed to that. So that's going to be a great spot for people to find out about us. But in addition to that, we have tours that we do every day from at 11 and 4, which is a great way just to understand the space, because we're about 22,000 square feet now. We take up a whole block in Southeast, and there's a lot of different things going on, everything from recycling, so breaking down computers, to breaking down objects that come in that are electronic, separating them into their component parts so that we can sustainably recycle those, And then we have a desktop build area, Apple Mac build area. We've got a devices build area where we do cell phones and iPads.
What? This is like a laptop this is like build total, area. You're like basically describing a new makerspace.
I know, wait. Or
yeah, describing since 2000,
like Willy Wonka, except everything's made out of silicon.
Yeah, we're all looking at each other like, oh, let's go.
Make the Snozberry devices.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of an amazing place. And, you know, the part that I love about Free Geek is the community that this creates. Like, everybody is demystifying all this technology. So it's a black box until you take it apart and you realize it's really just pieces of silicon in there. And there's other moving parts. But it demystifies that technology. But then people start building on that. What can I do with this now? Mm-hmm. Right? So we have education classes that teach you how to get on your computer and teaches you 3D graphics and how to make your own CNC machine. You know, it's amazing what we teach here, but it's the community that gets created. There are people that come here that have donated 4,000 hours of their volunteer time just to Free Geek because it's the place is incredibly diverse. And as a result of that diversity, we have incredible innovation. So people are always reinventing things. It's a great place to come and learn how to create, learn how to create within the computer world. There's a lot of entrepreneurs that have come through here that are now coming back to the Free Geek store and picking up what they need in order to develop their own business that they're reselling into eBay, or they're rebuilding things into from a basic computer into a gaming computer, and then they're able to resell that. So,
and that's awesome, Dan. And so before your website actually launches, what would that web address be, and where can folks find your actual location?
Thank you. It's www.freegeek.org, and there is a website up there, but I apologize for some of the pages.
You don't have to apologize to us.
We understand.
Indeed. Thank you. And then we're at 1731 Southeast 10th. So just up to Hawthorne till you get, you know, a couple streets up, make a right, and we're in it. We're 10th and Mill.
Beautiful. Well, thanks, Dan, so much for filling us in on Free Geek. Congratulations on the website and the growth that is happening. And yeah, our listeners will definitely enjoy getting their hands on some tech over there.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, of course, thank you. Take care.
Man, doesn't it make you feel warm and fuzzy to live in Portland?
You're like, it's so close. I want to go build things. Yeah.
One thing that I learned about recently that Free Geek was pretty instrumental in doing was to further a comprehensive digital equity plan. So one of the things that was really, you know, like sometimes is a little hard accessibility wise, in terms of being part of that makerspace culture in learning technology, is that like sometimes we don't quite have access to it in a way that, like, you know, it is safe, that we can learn from. Mm-hmm. And so I remember Free Geek and, you know, folks from Metro East and the Multnomah County Library put together a really great digital equity plan that brings technology to populations everywhere, that talks about like what internet deserts look like. Mm-hmm. And in order for the demystification of this technology to happen across the board, that sort of needs to happen. And they were leaders in that process. So I wanted to just bring that up too.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's really
very
cool.
And I like how there's these different organizations that are collaborating, but then also creating events that people can attend, like in the city and stuff. And I wanted to keep it going on the terms of like technology and creating spaces. There was an event that happened earlier this year called BetaCon.
That's right.
And it was a kind of an indie gaming event. And Rob, you were able to go there, as well as one of our collective members, Kyle. and talk to a few folks about that. Tell us a little bit about your experience before we play some recordings from that.
So BetaCon was pretty cool. I believe it was over Easter weekend.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the convention center was pretty barren, except for BetaCon. I want to say there was one other thing in the building, and that might have been like a cheerleading thing. But
okay.
I mean, that's cool, but yeah.
BetaCon was a sort of one room everything. Video game expo of sorts. It had a main stage in the middle of the room where basically panelists would get up and, you know, rap on a topic for a little while. Off to one side, you had Portland Indie Game Squad with a really impressive display of locally made video games. And then you had like arcade areas. I believe there was a DDR area, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
And
Dance Revolution, oh, for yes. those that don't know the acronym.
Yes. isn't it a type of RAM too? DDR RAM? Yeah.
Yes,
it is. Yes. It could be confusing.
Nerd alert.
So, yeah, pretty cool. I believe that this was the first BetaCon to go off. I can't remember the sponsors at this point because it was a little while ago. But I did meet up, and what you're about to hear is an interview with some folks from, I believe it's Bits and Bytes.
Bits and Bytes, and then also Pig Squad as well. So let's take a listen to our collage from BetaCon.
I'm Ian McClellan. My company is Think On Labs.
And you're part of Pig Squad?
Yeah, I'm a member of the Pig Squad. We get together, have a great little community, and get to meet other game developers, artists, sound people, and other people in the kind of indie industry. And yeah, it's been a great opportunity to network.
How did Pig Squad start?
I guess I credit Will with that the most, that it seems like he's kind of the driving force of this community of, you know, creating events, and, you know, they formed this nonprofit, him, Will and Corey. And I don't know their early history of how they got into it. I joined 2 years ago or so when I was getting more into game development, and, you know, found out about this through some friends in the neighborhood, and yeah, that was my story with it.
How did you and your team get the idea for your game, and how did it progress as you worked on it?
Sure. So yeah, Brian was one of my main contributors. We met at Global Game Jam, which was a Pig Squad event, and then. After that, I wanted to find some kind of new project. The VR headsets came out, and I was trying to think of like how all the old classic game styles are new again in VR. You can think of any kind of fun thing that was done in the past and say, how could that be done special and new in this new medium? So we took a classic kind of block stacking game and reimagined that for VR. So you grab these shapes and kind of physically manipulate them with your hands. Instead of just using a controller, you're grabbing at the block, rotating it, snapping it in place, and enjoying that spatial reasoning puzzle.
It's a matter of attributing a classic gaming structure to newer technology.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah, that any of those old mechanics are new again. Yeah, I think the early days of VR, people, even earlier than now, people were like flailing about a lot, trying to port games into it, and you don't want to have something that's not custom for VR. You want it to be something you can only do in VR and something that was built for VR. So that's why I say, like, these old games, you're not going to just go create an arcade cabinet that's a virtual and then play Tetris in VR. That won't be that fun. But, like, taking that concept of stacking things together and saying, okay, how could I physically do that different with a 3D interface? Like, now you could create something new.
Anything you want to add?
Yeah, so yeah, we've had a great time here showing at BetaCon. It is, it's been great to have a whole wide variety of kind of people from Portland, people that haven't seen VR before, try it out. Really built this game to be accessible to a mainstream audience so that any, you know, a VR newbie or a person who doesn't even like games, they can get in there, understand it right away, play it, and enjoy it right away. And then it also scales up for even hardcore gamers, that it's got enough complexity that they're challenged by it and get excited too. So it's been great to see that reaction and see the work I've put in over time to improve it really start showing off now, that it's just been flowing and been easily enjoyable by everyone.
All right, so what was your name?
Wick Perry.
Wick. Oh, so it's called Wick. Your company is Wickworks. All right. So,
I'm well branded.
All right, nice. So can you tell me about the game you have on display?
Yeah, so this game is one where you kind of build creatures by putting their joints and muscles together and then weaving their brains in order to get them to swim. And it kind of grew out of my neuroscience research, where I really wanted an interactive way to see how small nervous systems worked. And so I decided to make a game out of it and then make it really accessible. So it, what I wanted to be is the best way for people to learn basic neuroscience, but not realize that they're doing so.
Slip in the educational pool. It kind of reminded me of the physics game, The Incredible Machine, except it has its own sentient life. Like, I'm looking at the screen now, and the creature I developed, which is just, like, two long legs, is still squirming around, still doing its thing. So I guess to make a game like this, what do you value in game creation and game playing?
Well, there's always this balance between accessibility and, like, scientific accuracy, or I'm always going to have to make compromises between kind of like how real it is or how scientifically accurate and how easy it is to pick up. And I'm coming down pretty hard on the side of accessibility, where if like it really comes down to the wire and it's like either I have something that's complicated but nobody understands or something that's like kind of more simplified, I'm going to come down on something that makes people have a good experience playing it. And so kind of my experience as a game developer and like making other games has given me like a lot of tools that I feel like other scientists don't have, where they just kind of like make their thing without thinking about what the end user experience is. So I'm really excited to have this kind of fusion and be able to use my skills as both a scientist and a game developer to make something that anybody can play and is also like scientifically valid.
Yeah, it's definitely a good thing to fuel your interests together so they fuel each other. And then you grow in both, and also you're unique in both of those fields separately.
So I've actually been already figuring things out about neurons that I didn't know before.
Like what?
There's this thing where we say, okay, like neurons are active and they're firing. They actually take a little bit of time to charge up and get above this threshold to decide whether or not they fire. And if they have a lot of kind of small processes, it actually makes them a little bit more leaky and makes it longer for them to charge up. So that's actually led to a bug in the game, where if you have too many of wires coming off of a single neuron, then it just, like, won't fire. And I've never heard any, like, scientists talk about that, and I wouldn't have discovered that without this kind of, like, visual interactive representation to, like, just see what different situations could arise and what results they cause.
Definitely when you're creating something, it's a good sign when you're, it's less of you're making something up and more you're on the verge of discovery.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the game's called Crescent Loom. Is there anything you want to add about it?
I have it available for pre-order on itch.io. And you can also play it online at wick.works.
Also, how did you get associated with Pig Squad?
I've been coming to Pig Squad meetings, I think, for like 3 or 4 years now. Back when they were still like small, like groups of like a dozen people meeting in a PSU classroom. And they've just been like such a valuable resource and community as a game developer. It's really influenced a lot of ways that I think about making games, and also has given me a lot of opportunities to come to events like BetaCon and test out my games in front of a general audience.
This is Robert Lagos reporting from BetaCon, and I'm here with Bits and Bytes PDX. And your name, sir?
Merritt Lawrenson.
So, Matt, do you want to tell me a little bit about what Bits and Bytes is all about, what you're doing here at BetaCon?
Sure. Bits and Bytes is a... we do elementary classes and tutoring for all ages. So we do classes in the Portland Public Schools after school for grades 3 through middle school, and we do tutoring for everyone from pre-literacy through adults in college.
Very cool. So how long has the organization been together?
We've been around for about 2 years.
Is this a PDX-only thing, or are there like sister or brother chapters out there?
Nope, it's just us. Maybe in the future.
Oh, very cool. I've got a kid that's pre-school right now, but yeah. So there's enough time for you to grow up into that region. So what does your program generally entail for say, like high schoolers or middle schoolers? Or actually, what age range are we talking? That's a good question.
Right. Well, it depends on the age range. For elementary kids, for the younger elementary, we start out with things like maybe Codable or Scratch Junior, where we can teach them the basics of just starting to put together the idea of thinking in an algorithm, in a sequence, putting commands together. That's a little bit harder because they need they're pre-readers, so they need things that don't have words. They can't really do real programming. But by the time they're in the second to fifth grade classes, which are the main elementary classes we teach, then we can start them off with the Scratch, which is a building block language. So instead of typing in code, you can just put in the blocks and rearrange blocks to build your programs. So then they can make stories, they can make animations, they can make games. They love making video games. They love, you know, putting memes in their video games, all that sort of stuff. By the time they're in middle school, then we can start teaching them the basics of web development. So we can start teaching them HTML, CSS, and maybe getting into JavaScript. By the time they're in high school, then we can really start diving in into maybe hardware, something like a Raspberry Pi, or even like building computers. We can start doing harder JavaScript, getting into actual programming, and even make it maybe moving towards being job ready.
Super cool. Yeah, I mean, I love the idea of using games as a building block to teach coding, and I love the goal-oriented nature of your organization. So, well done, sir.
And thank you.
Yeah, and if people are looking for your organization, where do they go? Where can they find you?
You can find us at www.bitsandbytespdx.com.
Very cool. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
And then that was our little collage there from BetaCon. Thanks to the guys that were in Pig Squad. If you want more information about Pig Squad or the Portland Indie Game Squad, as the acronym is spelled, you can check them out at pigsquad.com. If you want to play test the Crescent Loom video game that Kyle was interviewing about, you can go to wick.works to test it out. And... yeah, a PDX Bits and Bytes. That just sounded like a really cool organization, how they're teaching kids to code.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. More accessibility. Yeah.
Cool. If you are just joining us, this is Radio Geekly. We're talking about Portland makers and the maker movement. I've got Becky and Rob here in the studio.
Hello.
And yeah, makers are just one of those community building things that I think is awesome that we can kind of come together and have our creativity mm-hmm. flow in
indeed.
Masses.
It yes. makes me excited to have a small child.
Yeah,
right,
you're mentioning
are you going
in that
to
interview.
Imprint about him.
Right.
Yeah, I heard you were saying, hey, if you want to move up to Vancouver to teach my kid how to yeah. code, that'd be awesome.
It's the Oakland of Portland.
Okay. Don't Oakland's way cooler, so mm-hmm. there you go. No, I mean way cooler than SF. So therefore Vancouver's cooler.
Okay, thanks for clarifying that.
Sorry. I am also for the listeners out there, I am totally uncaffeinated. So
that she is, might say things. That
is yeah, right. I'm just like my brain is not keeping up with my mouth. Anyway,
that's okay. But I thought it was just really cool how with like the makerspaces, not only can you go in the city to learn about things, but yes. you can be in a school kind of environment, educational wise, to learn how to create and make. And for those listeners that might not be in grades K through 12. There's also other opportunities that you can check out at one of our local community colleges. And I was fortunate enough to chat with a gentleman named Ed Ivory, who is the director of Maker Lab at PCC Sylvania campus, and just kind of getting his insight on Maker Lab and what they do and stuff like that. So I thought we can kind of transition from talking in the public platform of going to events to more of an educational school setting. So let's take a listen to that, my interview with Ed Ivory. Ed, how's it going?
Pretty good, Jesse. How are you today?
I am doing okay. Hey, thanks for taking the time to chat with me a little bit about makers. So my first question I have for you is, what got you into becoming a maker?
I've always been fairly mechanical, but I don't think that that's necessarily a requisite for becoming a maker or something that you need to have in order to become a maker. The word maker is the newest word for the oldest thing, to borrow some lines from prominent people in the maker community. We've got this desire as humans to create tools and things to better our lives and to better the lives of the people around us. So being a maker really is just the newest word for helping yourself and helping other people with creative problem solving.
Cool. So how did you get yourself involved with PCC Maker Lab?
PCC Maker Lab kind of came as a shot out of the dark. I had chosen to move to Portland initially because of Maker Faire. That was one of the biggest draws. It was a very vibrant, is a very vibrant community of makers in Portland compared to where I had been living in Tacoma. While there are makers in Tacoma, I needed a new start. And so I said, well, Portland looks like a great shot. And it's kind of still in the Pacific Northwest. So it seemed like a really good choice. And I'm glad I moved there. From there, I was interacting with people at Maker Faire, and they ended up connecting me with somebody at PCC that really was looking for somebody to take over Maker Lab and make it something meaningful to the students and the community as well.
Awesome. So what exactly goes on in a Maker Lab?
Maker Lab is a place for people to bring their curiosity and creativity and kind of mash those up and see what happens. We have 3D printers, laser cutters, a lot of PCC students that are already interested in helping other people. Our Plus STEAM Club is run by some really amazing students, and they do everything from pouring hot aluminum into things to making like these magnetic trains using rare earth magnets and batteries and copper wire to, I think this year they're planning on making a battery-powered hovercraft to fly around the school, which should be pretty interesting, but they actually want to put somebody on a chair and have them, you know, shot all over campus, centimeters over the ground. So yeah, that'll be pretty entertaining to watch, but they're really, the community is really the lifeblood of something like Maker Lab, because the kind of mentoring that happens there is something that is, well, it's not necessarily unique. It's really powerful because you have somebody that already knows how to build something, and you have another person who wants to build something else. And the first person kind of gives them the ability to bounce ideas off of them and get this kind of synergy going between people. And when they get excited about their projects, that's really, I guess, the biggest benefit to anybody is having a community of people around them. And Maker Lab is a place for that community to gather.
Very cool. What have been some of the projects that you have enjoyed being a part of?
We have a lot of entertaining little things that go on from time to time. A lot of the bigger projects are things that people will work on, like there's 3D scanners that people have built in the lab, where it's a turntable that's essentially, it's automated. It uses your phone. They didn't design it themselves, but they made some modifications to the design, and then they built it. It uses an iPhone or an Android, and you plug your headset into that. It has a little mic button, and there's a wheel that indexes around, and it taps the mic button. And as that wheel's indexing around, it's also spinning the object that you're scanning on a turntable with, you know, a very straightforward process. We can take those images, drop them into some really cool software that's put out for free by Autodesk. Those images become a mesh within that software, and that mesh can then be turned around and modified or edited and then 3D printed out or translated into something that could be laser cut.
Whoa, that sounds pretty elaborate.
It is elaborate. One of the guys at the shop decided that he wanted to build the catapult, and so we actually made rubber band powered catapults. He had seen someone else's design online, and he came up with a new way to do it. And these catapults will shoot mini marshmallows about 60 feet. We got to take those to OMSI after dark, and people absolutely loved them. They were just a lot of fun to showcase and, you know, launch marshmallows at people. You can't get better than that.
Yeah, that sounds pretty awesome. I could just picture somebody on the other end of the catapult, like, trying to catch the marshmallows in their mouth.
It's surprisingly difficult to do that part.
Wow.
Well, you have to think, over 60 feet, there's a lot of room for error to happen.
I guess so, yeah. Projectile.
You know, ballistics and math and all this stuff.
Right.
And they're a lot of fun to use, but they're not refined in the mathematics sense.
Yeah. So you were talking about how makers kind of seem to be built around a community. And for this show, we were kind of focusing on makers in general here in Portland. What is your take in terms of makers in the city as Portland is kind of growing and developing all these new ideals and things like that?
one of the things about Portland that has a very positive effect on any community, makers included, is that they're very welcoming to the people that have been thrown to the outskirts of American society. And we're on the forefront of saying, hey, we love you. You're a person. You are human, and you are valid because you are human. We want you to feel loved and included here. That's the biggest thing I think that Portland has going for it in terms of being, you know, a haven or sanctuary city or any of these labels we want to throw around.
Mm-hmm.
Just the simple fact of loving people is the biggest thing that Portland has done and will continue to do, I believe, for actually encouraging the growth of not just any specific community, but all communities. And I think that a lot of people who feel like they don't know who they are, they don't have their identity figured out, they haven't come into their own as an adult or whatever, Portland has done, as a culture, really amazing job of saying, you know, you're broken, we're broken, let's just figure it out. And there's always room for improvement. Human love is never a perfect thing when it comes to loving one another, but we actually try in Portland, and I think that's pretty fantastic.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I know Radio Geekly, we try to embrace all the inclusiveness, but come together and know, like, hey, we're all geeks here. We can all do cool things together. So it translates on multiple platforms.
Certainly does.
So is there any projects or big things that you're looking forward to with Maker Lab, or like any upcoming events that you want to give our listeners some info about?
Well, we will be running costume workshops on Mondays from 1 to 4 leading up to Halloween. And that'll be a lot of fun. Come on over to Portland Community College, Sylvania, and check out Maker Lab. We're a little bit hard to find, unfortunately. We're in the AM building on the bottom floor, room 101. I'll apologize in advance for being hard to find. But yeah, we'll be running those costume workshops for the rest of the Mondays, for the rest of this month leading up to Halloween. And we don't have a whole lot that is mentionable yet, but there are definitely some fun things in the making.
Very cool. And I'm sure the college's website has like links to Maker Lab and stuff like that?
Yes. If you go to pcc.edu/maker, you will find a webpage that links to all of the makerspaces that PCC has to offer, but you'll also find information regarding our learning gardens. You'll see things for design labs, the STEM Center. There's a host of different maker inclusive and maker-directed initiatives at PCC, and we very recently brought that all into one roof and made that into something that's really accessible to a lot of people. If you have any questions, by all means, check out our website, and my email address will be right there.
Wonderful. Well, Ed Ivory, Director of Maker Lab at PCC Sylvania, thanks so much for taking time to speak with me tonight.
Thank you, Jesse. Have a good one.
And yes, thanks again to Ed. And what an awesome way for folks to get educated on makerspaces, or even just have a place to let your creative juices flow.
Indeed.
Absolutely.
Because you need a space. And, you know, if I started pulling computers apart in my living room, yeah, my wife probably wouldn't be too keen on that.
I mean, your son probably would.
Yeah, he'd be like, oh, yeah, I'm going to bang
What's
these
up
things
with this?
Together. Yeah.
Yes.
Ooh, ram chips, they bang real good.
Right, these wires, yum. I'm like, no.
They tingle on my tongue.
Don't do that. Yeah, I love that there are a number of different venues that work on the idea of collectivity and make a space in, or like a physical space that's necessary outside of, you know, one's home, one's own, you know, ability to have a space.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
It's important for it.
And even beyond that, like, you know, once you have your amazing thing that you've made, then once a year we have Mini Maker Fair here in town.
Yes.
That's right.
And Jess and I were just there.
Yeah.
it was
awesome.
We were at at the Game Lab Oregon table. Mm-hmm. Jess, you were representing Chickskin Game.
Yeah, my company that I have with a couple other ladies, trying to bring inclusiveness to the gaming industry, more people to the table, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of one of our first events to get our name out there. But Maker Faire was just really cool to kind of see all the different makers in the city and what we can do. And we were teaching folks how to make buttons with our label on it, our logo on
it.
So.
Yeah, because who doesn't want to make a button?
Yeah.
I just don't know.
I found the space was actually really well organized in terms of like similar things being grouped together this time around. Like what Turbine Hall was dedicated to games, the auditorium was dedicated to an opus of 3D printing, which was mind-blowing. The little dark corner area in between the auditorium and Turbine Hall had Tesla coils, so it didn't matter that it was dark. It was perfect.
Right, yeah.
And also it's out of the way, so nobody's going to get zapped accidentally.
Yeah.
And by a Tesla coil, we're talking about a 500,000 volt Tesla coil. Mm. So something that's like, whoa, now that's an arc.
Right.
You can toast a marshmallow on that.
Yeah. That would have been a cool like collab for sure. The Tesla coils and the mini marshmallow catapult.
I was actually thinking about that. As I was hearing that, I'm like, so how many BTUs would you have to like have and you know in the path of the flying marshmallow to toast it as it like Ooh, you know
yeah,
went to its
given
arc?
It's like
and then on the other end you have like a graham cracker and a piece of chocolate, try to like catch Raisin? The marshmallow.
Yeah.
So we challenge you, dear listeners, if you are Rube Goldberg fanatics, here is your inspiration. Tesla coil, marshmallow, how do you make it work? So you have a s'more.
Must include catapult.
Must include catapult. Your design spec. There it is.
There you go. Oh, man. Yeah, but Maker Faire is really cool because it's more than just being in Portland. Like, it's kind of a network of different fairs and stuff. Mm-hmm. And the original space wasn't in Oregon, right, Rob? Like, where did do you know where Maker Faire originated?
I believe Maker Faire originated in San Francisco. I think that's the origin. And I want to say it comes out of Make Magazine. And I believe we might have a caller calling in from Make Magazine momentarily.
Oh, sweet.
Yes.
Yeah. And she'll be telling us a little bit more in depth about that.
Yeah.
Indeed.
But I think that's really cool how Maker Faire has not only transposed throughout the city, but also through different states and like nationwide as well. So we can more folks that are, you know, might be listening to our show on the interwebs and not on a terrestrial radio.
Yeah.
If you
connect to us through Facebook, let us know what the maker scene in your space looks like. Mm-hmm. I've been to one in Minneapolis. It was really cool. And I know that cities around the country have to have a really vibrant scene. So go to Radio Geekly on Facebook. Let us know. You know, what does Makerspace in your city look like?
Yeah, facebook.com/Radio Geekly. And while you're at it, you can follow us on Twitter. You can tweet at us at Radio Geekly. It's capital R, capital G. Mm-hmm. Or if you just want to send us a good old-fashioned email and talk to us about your Makerspaces, you can send us an email at aradiogeekly@kboo.fm. And we should have our caller here calling in from Maker Magazine, Paloma Juanita Fotley. Is that how her last name is pronounced?
I believe so.
Okay.
Of the famous Fotleys of the San Francisco area.
Oh, hello.
Paloma, are you there?
Yes, I am here.
Good morning.
Good morning. My reputation precedes me.
So, Paloma, do you want to give us the lowdown on Make Magazine, how Make Magazine relates to Maker Faires, and maybe how you fit into the equation?
Sure. So, Make Magazine is actually a magazine that started in the North San Francisco Bay Area. It was actually started under O'Reilly Media. So O'Reilly is for all those, like, geeks like me that read all those technical books with the animals on it. That's O'Reilly. And they got this crazy idea to start a magazine about people who like to tinker around and make stuff themselves instead of just going to the store and buying it. And so they started this really cool magazine, and then the founder thought, well, what if we just had like a meetup where all of us got to hang out together? So in San Mateo, which is south of San Francisco, they said, well, let's have a maker fair, which is like a show and tell plus a science fair plus CES kind of all wrapped together. And so the first one happened the same year that the first magazine came out, and they've just both blown up ever since.
Sweet. So yeah. What can we find in Make Magazine? Like, can you give us some examples of, like, are there special issues to address certain niches of makerism, or is there an online resource that we might, you know, peruse with keywords?
Totally. So every magazine has a theme. So there are some that are like about Halloween and some that are about things that are dangerous, and everyone is really fun and they have projects that fit into that theme. But Make and Maker and the making community is so intentionally vague, so that way anybody who really makes stuff can be a part of the community. So like, I did articles through them that were about cooking and molecular gastronomy, and also about like making circuit stickers and, you know, just a totally weird wide range of things. So if you are into it at all, if you like...
Oh. Hello?
Oh, no!
Goodness.
Oh, no! We lost her! Oh, no!
Well, I remember these.
Holding us in suspense if we like to.
I'm guessing she'll be back momentarily.
Where should we call?
That's okay. But
I know where. I know. Can I answer?
Oh, yes.
She's calling back right now.
Okay, cool. It's makezine.com.
Makezine.
Makezine.com. Also, I would also like to interject. I have seen Make Magazine do really awesome work with Humble Bundle. So if you're looking... If you're looking to get your make fix on a budget and you're willing to, you know, buy a little bit of time, or maybe you're a Humble Bundle enthusiast, check out their book section, because I see Make Magazine popping in there all the time.
Oh, yeah.
So you not only get your charity donation fix, you also get your Make Magazine fix.
I know, you get it all.
Yeah.
And we it's have
amazing.
Aloha back. Hello.
Hi.
Hi, so sorry about that. as I was saying, there's you were saying there's like a ton of stuff on Humble Bundle, which is awesome, but they also have a completely free online resource. If you go to makezine.com, just M-A-K-E-Z-I-N-E, they have all of their projects that are in the magazine. They have really cool articles about people doing interesting things in the maker like community, and they have just like links to where you can find really cool retailers that sell stuff so you can start making on your own.
That sounds amazing.
Super cool.
We have so many things that we have to do after this show.
we are all going to need to quit our jobs just to do...
to make things.
Right? So, Paloma, so as a maker yourself, what gets you going as a maker?
So I'm actually about to finish my degree in robotics engineering, which sounds very fancy-schmancy and like I should be this awesome, cool robot girl, which, you know, I am. But also, awesome. I really love terrible, just awful robots. Robots that don't work very well and are just kind of comically sad at their job. So I actually started a competition down in Santa Cruz called the Hackathon, which is like a hackathon, but it's hacky. You have 12 hours to build a really terrible robot, and you're going to fail, and there's no way you can do anything that actually works in that time. But you learn to like embrace failure and have fun with technology instead of being kind of intimidated by it.
That sounds awesome. So are you going to franchise this out to other cities?
I'm starting the whole thing.
Pacific Northwest, maybe?
Because I've got some rubber bands and some PVC, and I want to build a robot.
Well, you know what? Go for it. I'm actually going to be giving a talk on building terrible robots at the East Bay Mini Maker Fair on October 22nd. So if anybody finds their way in the San Francisco Bay Area and wants to check it out, you're welcome to come and see me talk about it. But also, there's really no reason you couldn't just have your friends over for a fun weird night, buy a bunch of random components, you know, teach yourself some basic Arduino or some board that you can get started with, and then just start building something dumb. You know, if the goal is to fail, you can't do it wrong.
That sounds amazing. That sounds like I think you've just described our next Saturday Night Gathering.
Yep.
Right. Yeah. We're just going to make some robots. No expectations except that they're going to be terrible.
So just out of curiosity, to connect this to the interwebs, Paloma, do you have a blog or anywhere that our listeners could go to learn more about terrible robot building?
Well, I mean, there are so many awesome things that you can check out online to find out about that. Like Simone Yetch with Tested is really great. But if you want to hear more from me, I have a Twitter. I use it occasionally. So you can follow me, Paloma Fotley, on Twitter, or you can look me up on makezine.com. And if you search my name, Paloma, Paloma Fotley, you'll find some really cool articles I've written so you can make in my footsteps. And if you're listening to this and want to find out more about what I'm doing, just shoot me a message on Twitter and I would love to talk to you.
Awesome. Thank you so much for calling in. Thank you so much for the input. You've been awesome.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, and definitely send me an invite to that next Saturday gathering.
You got it. Yes. Come on up.
All right. Take care.
You too.
So as we're wrapping up the show, man, I feel like we can be talking about this for like another hour.
Yeah, right. Maybe it's like another show.
Yeah.
I don't know. Another show.
But alas, we only have just a few more minutes. So in those moments, I wanted to talk about some upcoming events that our listeners can check out as well as for us.
Because it's October, the best month of the year.
Yay! Why is that?
Because of Halloween and costumes. And we live in Portland, which is naturally predisposed to costumes regardless of what month. But it's just like, if we have a reason, now everybody's into it.
Highly distilled.
So if you're thinking of something to do maybe this weekend, the H.P. Lovecraft Film Fest and Cthulhu Con is happening this weekend, October 6th through the 8th at the Hollywood Theater.
Wait, 6th? That's today.
That is today.
Whoa, holy cow.
Holy cats. Info and tickets can be found at hplfilmfestival.com. Tomorrow, October the 7th, Fright Town is back. Underneath the Veterans Memorial Coliseum. Yes. Information can be found at frighttown.com. That's two T's, FRIGHTTOWN.com.
Go if you dare.
On October 25th, OMSI is putting on their next After Dark event. And Rob, you are highly involved because there are some extraterrestrial beings that might be present.
I may build the After Dark Halloween game. I don't know how many years this has been. It's either 3, 4, maybe more. I lose track sometimes. Anyway, yeah, this year is aliens. So if you see aliens walking around, you can find the game desk at the front of the event, and it's free to play.
Yeah.
And we do have prizes. So come
like,
on down.
Do you have like Reese's Pieces to hand out?
Oh, more like museum passes.
Oh.
And movie passes for the museum. Gotcha. And yeah, maybe we'll have other stuff. We've had wine in the past.
So if you want to find out more, you can go to omsi.edu/afterdark and all the info is there. The Phantom PDX Halloween Warehouse Costume Party will happen on October 28th. For those of you that want to showcase your costume in all its glory, go to phantompdx.com. Also on October 28th at the Lone Fir Cemetery is the Tour of Untimely Departures from 5 to 9 p.m. Info at ticketswest.com.
And I got to call that out because that is a unique and awesomely Portland experience. Mm-hmm. Basically, you have an in-costume tour guide tell the stories of the deceased that are buried at the graveyard.
Wow.
It's real. It's not like, oh, that's a ghost here.
No. Yeah. This person.
And this person was stabbed to death. No.
Check out this particular grave. Okay.
Yeah. Well, if all the things in October, one last thing to check out maybe in November that we'll also mention is OriCon on November 17th through 19th at the Red Lion Jansen Beach Hotel. Fantasy sci-fi convention. Go to 39.oricon.org for more information. Thank you to Rob and Becky and all the phone callers, Dan and Paloma, and all the people that we got to interview. I've been Just Jess. This has been a Radio Geekly. Stay tuned at noon for Moving On, and we will catch you all next month.
Bye.
Bye.